Grateful Dead from American Beauty and Box of Rain to talk about that and much more. We're joined by our friend, writer Colin Fleming. His newest book, Meatheads Say the Realest Things, is available everywhere. Hello there, Colin.
What's up, Rich Guy Kimball?
Well, you have immersed me in a wonder of culture over the last 48 hours, as you so often do, and great to listen to that song in the American Beauty album. And I'm not a huge Dead fan, but you've got me more and more appreciative of their works. And that one, great song from Phil Lesh and Robert Hunter, that is about the death, what was at the time the impending death of Phil Lesh's dad.
Does it make you nervous?
it does a little bit, yes.
I think I can get you there, Kimball. I've been considering this lately, and the Grateful Dead have been done a huge disservice by how we tend to think about things. Mm. We don't question things that much. We just kind of go along with something, especially if it's in place for decades. I think it's very easy to sort of write the Dead off as, oh, I'm sure they're interesting and they're cool, but they're for stoners and they're for hippies, and who wants those dirty, unwashed hippies, right? Guys like us. We like hockey and fierce body chess, all of these things. Kimbo, you get it. But if you listen, if you just sort of block out the noise, as Coach Belichick would say, you listen to a song like this. I previously had numbers like The Beatles, Here, There, and Everywhere, and especially The Kinks' Waterloo Sunset is the most beautiful songs I know. I would say this is probably the most beautiful song I've ever heard. It is emotionally devastating. It is as wise as art can be. I was going to say like within 4 or 5 minutes, but I'll just pretty much go along with as wise as music can be. It's poetry, it's gripping, it does things with gender, because like you said, it's ostensibly a song about Phil Lesh's own father who was dying. He writes the music, Robert Hunter comes in and he writes the words. He says the words wrote themselves, but there are these little cues, too, within the lyric, like a ribbon for your hair, that feminize masculinity and makes it, like, if you've ever been around a dying relative, like a male dying relative, you do things of great intimacy with them that you might not have done at another point prior. You hold their hand. If they're in a coma, you might brush their hair, something like that. And this song nails that kind of fraternal, but more than fraternal, intimacy.
And I guess my impression as a casual Dead listener through the years has been, you know, jam band, great jam band, very talented, certainly. But also from my perspective as an outsider in the world of the Dead, not a group that dug terribly deep. And then you listen to a song like that and it just rips you apart.
They might be. If you told me this, I wrote this on the blog, if you were the god of reality and you masquerade as Rich Guy Kimball and you tapped me on the shoulder and said, look, I have some news for you. Grateful Dead and Joy Division are the two best rock and roll bands there have ever been, Mr. Beatles Guy Fleming. I wouldn't quibble with you like a ton. Like, I could believe that that's actually the reality of reality. I might not agree with it, but it wouldn't be like, oh no, I'm so incredulous. It can't possibly be that. The god of reality screwed up. I think there's a depth to this music that is as deep as American history, as deep as Americana gets, as deep as Walt Whitman and Herman Melville and Nathaniel Hawthorne and FitzHenry Lane. I think that this band does things that, again, even the notion of the jam band, that's overstated. Like, if you even just look at the lengths of the track, sure, they have some long ones, but don't forget The Who, the Fillmore East in 1968 are jamming on My Generation for 30 minutes, the Allman Brothers, Mountain Jam. The Dead, they don't really do that. They're usually within the song structure, especially in the 1970s. They're not doing a lot of the things that they're doing in 1968. And the song that's kind of out there, like Dark Star, it's not really that. It's still sonic and song-oriented, like even though there's no lyric for long stretches of it. So this song, and you have the poetry of, what do you want me to do for you to see you through? You have this interlocking, the pronouns, the you, and the harmony singing, the background singing. These guys sing harmony better than the Beach Boys and as well as the Beatles. And don't forget, the song begins with almost the exact same line that starts the Hollies' Look Through Any Window. The Dead were sort of this American version of a British invasion band, but better than almost all of the British invasion bands.
I was a casual Grateful Dead fan in my college years, high school years, but I had a chance to see them in 1990 in Buffalo. And yeah, the seeing them live even expanded beyond what I knew, my appreciation of them beyond what I knew from the catalog. They were a, as you said, a great band in their harmonies, in their the tightness of the instrumentation when they're performing live. I had a much deeper appreciation after getting a chance to see them in concert.
There's so many different things at once, too. I mean, fundamentally, they're a dance band. They're the same as the Duke Ellington Orchestra. I don't think Ellington's great orchestra is any better than the Grateful Dead as an ensemble. And Ellington ultimately came to your town in Fargo or wherever it was to play dances. It also happened to be art music at the same time. But the Dead are one of those bands where there's a long, trippy distance between what's happening in 1969 and what happens in 1970 with the songsmithing of Working Man's Dead and American Beauty, which this song is on. But I don't know that you can find a more efficacious, emotionally moving song to begin a record. It's almost like when this song starts the record, it's so daring. Because you think, where can you possibly go from here? You've started with something so writ large. The song was actually premiered at the Fillmore East 5 years to the day before I was born. I'm thinking of taking the last two, I mean, it's just brilliant writing. The last two lines of the song is an epigraph for Longer on the Inside. I never do that. I never cede over space in my books to anybody else's words. That might sound hubristic, but I don't like anyone infringing upon my writerly space. But here is one exception where I would do that. I think it complements and sort of encapsulates the idea. But if people have just sort of fallen lax with the whole jam band, you have to see them in concert, you can't do this anymore, psychedelics and all that, that's, you've been given a bum steer. And I hope I've engendered enough trust over the years in the writings for people to think, oh, this guy might actually be giving me like a sort of apt pointer here. Go back to this music, go back to this song. They're not the band that is typically how they're described.
And interesting too, if you listen to the vinyl, that you got Box of Rain, which opens side one, and then Ripple on side two, and there are some similarities there and some contrasts as well that take you also back to the days when the way you structured song sequence on an album was part of your artistic credo as well.
Oh, I learned more from that song structuring, as you call it, than I did from academia or anything like that. These were, in some ways, I mean, I had other books too, but these were my books. And listen to the potency of the command words of Box of Rain, where the lines start with watch or look or inch. It's giving someone who is passing out of this world direction and guidance. And it's also a reminder that wonder does not cease at what we might think of as the end of one journey. And I think that's key, because this is sort of a grand journey of life and death. But if you give someone 2 weeks to live, you can live more in 2 weeks than someone else can in a lifetime, if you know how to do it, if you embrace the vulnerability and new experiences. And I think that serves you well on whatever the next aspect of your journey is going to be. It's a very comforting song, this idea of what can I do for you? You hear the repetition? It's so fastidious in the reaching out to another human being. What can I do for you? It's more than just like, what can I do for you, man? It's so much more than that. Instead, the tale that's telling, instead the tale that's the stuff of timeless and great art.
Yeah, if you haven't listened for a while, go back and revisit not just Box of Rain, but American Beauty and the whole Grateful Dead catalog. We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. A very different listen, but very pleasurable as well, was checking out the first appearance on the BBC of the Beatles in 1962 with Pete Best on the drums and a great little five-song set of, I think, three covers and then a couple Beatles originals at the end.
Pete Best's best sterling moment as a member of the Beatles. So this is March 1962, to give people an idea of the chronology. Mr. Ringo Starr is going to come in August of that year. So they're going to close that year. In autumn, they're going to have Love Me Do come out. In December, Christmas time, they're going to have their last go-round in Hamburg at the Star Club. So this is when they just get started on the BBC, cut all these memorable sides. And it's, like I said, Pete Best is the drummer. And he gets mocked a lot. And they're really quite good here. He's certainly not the deterrent that you'll hear him to be on, like, the EMI test that George Martin runs later on, where he's like so just awful coming out of these fills on the songs they were doing at the time. But it's the Beatles' advance, man. The Beatles are clearly pumped. Like, this is a big day in the life, bit of a pun, if you were a Beatle. Like, this was huge. This is like the biggest day in your life up until that point.
And the vocals are very crisp. You can tell, you can see the promise of what lies ahead, and yet they're still very new and a bit raw in places.
It's funny because to start this year, January 1st, they have their audition for Decca Records. And if you listen to that tape, they're quite sterile. They're anodyne. They're not very good at all. So this is just like a few months after that. And a lot of their sound is pretty, even though it would be in flux, is pretty fully formed. Like, you can also hear the excitement, too, in their vocals. Like, Lennon always, and Please Mr. Postman, he would always almost over-emote. Like, he was so excited. Like, he has a hard time fitting in all of the words because they're also playing so, they're playing so quickly. But you'll hear the same thing when they get to the States in February of the next year, and they play their first U.S. concert in Washington at the Coliseum. And they have George Harrison sing the first number, which is really sort of strange. You wouldn't expect that. But it was Roll Over Beethoven, so they're not confident. They're thinking, okay, this is America, it's big, they all like Chuck Berry, we'll do this first. And then they do For Me to You after that, which is co-sung by Lennon and McCartney, and they're champing at the bit. They can't wait to have their turn and sort of like shove George out of the way, and that's sort of the energy, the vibe of this particular session. And it has, too, don't you think, a charm to it. When the introductions unfurl the way they do and John Lennon takes the vocal lead. It's this kind of quaint phraseology that it's like when you read a naval novel like Horatio Hornblower, you get the way What Ails the Ship. People just spoke in such a more edifying and classy and enriching kind of way. And they do this great cover with McCartney singing the vocal lead on Roy Orbison's Dream Baby, which you don't get to hear anywhere else in all of Beatledom. So that's how it actually gets kicked off.
From music, we go to the world of film. And I like to think I'm, on the big scale, above average in my knowledge of films. And I was aware of Powell and Pressburger's 1944 film Canterbury Tale, but I had not seen it before. And I guess my question now is, where has this film been all my life, and why didn't I watch it earlier? Because I was blown away by this beautiful movie that starts so simply as sort of a modern take on Chaucer's pilgrimage, and then becomes this beautiful meditation on the soul and on miracles and friendship. And it's just, man, it's just one of the best movies I've ever seen.
Journeys within journeys. Because you have three travelers coming in to this fictional town in Kent. It's like one stop removed from Canterbury and Canterbury Cathedral on the Old Road, the Pilgrim's Road, and one of them is an American sergeant, another is a British Army guy, and another is a shop girl who's had a great loss in her life not too far from these particular environs. And it sets up as a mystery when they come in. It was shot by a guy who was versed in German Expressionism. So it's like that feeling of being on a train or when you're little, you're in the back seat of your parents' car, and you want to get to where you're going, but you're also like so sleepy and it's so safe and comfortable. And the American sergeant, he gets off at the wrong stop. He's supposed to be going to Canterbury to eventually meet his buddy. He has a 3-day leave, and immediately we're entered into this, and they are too, of course, they're entered into this mystery of the glue man, this guy running out of nowhere in the darkness. And it's just so improbable, but it's so believable too. It actually, that's what you want as a writer. You want to have something that no one could ever see coming, but when it comes, it's like, ooh, this is compelling. It also makes sense. People can't pull that off. This guy dressed up in army attire runs out, dumps glue on this woman's head, and he runs off. And this has been happening throughout the village. So they end up trying to solve this mystery. Now, it's not like a mystery of who killed who or who abducted the kid. It's like I call it in this essay that I'm writing about this, like a shoebox mystery. It's not particularly consequential type of deal. But they end up derailed. And it's that idea, I think, that Lenin said of life is what happens while you're busy making other plans. But people don't normally realize that that's what's occurring. And Bob, in particular, the American, and this is the only role that this actor will ever have. He's going to retire. He's going to become, from film, if you can even call it that, he's going to become a teacher, donate the money he was paid to the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And he, in particular, experiences extreme amounts of growth that he doesn't ultimately want to leave, but he also wants to leave because he's better served now. And it's also a lesson, too, in the fact that you can have the truth, that you can have these daily miracles in life. Sometimes they happen and we're not even aware of them. But these people, all three, they become aware of the miracles in their own respective lives.
And I love the fact that the Archers, as Powell and Pressburger were known, cast largely unknown actors and a lot of locals as well. But everybody is so brilliant in this, from Sergeant John Sweet, the young American you mentioned. I love the guy who played the station agent. And so much of the film is done with just great humor that sometimes takes a while to sink in, but is so perfect.
You like when the station master comes back at the end, because we don't really expect to see him again. But he's so, like, he cuts such a memorable figure at the start. You know who also is great is the organist at the cathedral.
Yes.
The organist's main gig. And one of the, so the British Army guy, he is a cinema organist. And he's never been in a church or a cathedral where he's been able to play the organ. So he sort of ends up in the organ chamber, and the guy whose full-time gig it is, he lets him have a go because his battalion is going off to war. And that's something that's unstated too. It's very much John Knowles, separate piece. Two of these three people could be going to their death soon. I think that's something that you might not, like a person might not note that watching it the first time, because it's this kind of enclave. It's this world removed. And there's this back and forth because he's scared. He's hesitant. He's insecure. There's just this, Orson Welles said the best parts in his films were the parts that didn't advance the plot, and that's what people always want to take out. But what they really do advance is they advance the characterization. And characterization, if you're any good, is knit up with story. And so those parts that were taken out of the Welles films, they compromise the quality of his narrative, of his plots. And Powell and Pressburger, they allow them to flourish here. And the film is just endlessly rewatchable. And when she goes to her old caravan this woman had choose to camp out with, like her fiance, and he's been lost at war, and she goes in and everything in the caravan's been destroyed by moths, it's just like it lays you out. It really does. And when the miracle happens, it might not be a miracle, because it's like, okay, well, this could totally take place, but it is a miracle. You just have to know how to see them.
And I love the scene where the young woman and the man who turns out to be the glue man are just lying in the grass and hiding from the other two. And that's the countryside. The area becomes a real character in the film as well. And that juxtaposition of these modern military vehicles in this old road traveled by the pilgrims 600 years earlier.
Powell was from there, so it's his sort of Valentine to this land that he knew and he loved. And And you're right. They're not necessarily eavesdropping, but it's like we are having our time together and our friends are having their time together over there, which is just such a healthy amount of respect. But it ends up being this kind of awkward moment. But also you have the two army guys going up to the top of this hill, and it's just they want to take this walk together because they're not going to be in this place again probably. And they know that they're not the same as when they got there. The guys were solving the mystery of the glue man. They've solved the mystery, and they don't want to leave. And it's that feeling of bittersweetness when you know that something has reached its end, but you're, it's the whole cliche, like, don't be glad or don't be sad, it's over, be grateful it happened type of thing. This is sort of like the, again, the cinematic writ large version of that.
Well, it's a film you'll never forget if you haven't seen it before. The Canterbury, A Canterbury Tale. It's available on the Criterion Collection and Apple Plus and much more. So check that out. Finally, we move to the world of baseball and talk about one of the greats of all time, who, again, you forget how good he was until you go back and revisit the numbers of Gary Carter.
You do forget, but it's interesting because I remember Gary Carter. I was a kid, this young boy, but he was like in his prime. He was never spoken of as a guy who would go to the Hall of Fame. And it's just like, it's telling, like, sort of the narrative in place at one point in time. And then, like, maybe the reality later. I guess it's kind of a theme, even like this, baseball, Gary Carter, the Grateful Dead, that type of thing. But Gary Carter is possibly the second best catcher of the last 50 odd years. Now, I still think his problem compared to someone like Carlton Fisk, because Gary Carter was essentially done in his early 30s, and Fisk still had two acts left in his career. But this is fascinating to me. In 1982, you could make a very real argument that the best ball player in the world was Gary Carter.
Well, yeah, he played 154 games that year, which is incredible, at age 28. Hit .293, 29 homers, 97 runs batted in. Oh, threw in 32 doubles as well. Ridiculous OPS of .890. I mean, he just did everything.
Now, those statistics on the bald face might not look like, oh, how can you say he's the best in the world? Because he is essentially, he's like third in offensive war. He's second in defensive war. So he's one of the three best offensive players in the game and one of the three best defensive players in the game, if you believe in those particular metrics. He was a fantastic ball player and, like you said, racking up all of those games caught. And then I think it's just a couple years later, so 1984, he's leading the league in RBI. And it's like, well, somebody has to lead the league in RBI. I'm not sure if people necessarily know how hard it is for a catcher to lead the league in RBI. I mean, when people talk about Johnny Bench is the best catcher of all time, and he was a great defensive catcher and all of this, I'm pretty sure he led the league in RBI three times. And it comes back to that because you're playing less games, so you don't have as many opportunities. You have all of the wear and tear, and like your knuckles are all broken, your hands are all mangled, so like you're not really doing a whole lot in theory come August, September, all that wear and tear in the body and the heat and the crouching and all of this, you lose 20 pounds over the season, all of that stuff. Catcher leads the league in RBI. That's just like one of those stats where it's like, are you kidding me? Then you have a team like the 86 Mets, and you'd think because they were such an awesome generational team, but they only have one Hall of Famer. Now, a lot of that's the drugs, but they only have one Hall of Famer, and maybe Keith Hernandez is borderline. But Carter's the only guy from that sort of kind of like all-time type of team.
Well, he's just one of those steady performers. And as you said, the injuries caught up with him. Really, he was done as a productive player by the time he was about 32. Well, no, he's okay at 32 and 33, but by 34. And then he hung around. And isn't that the way quite often when guys hang around a little bit too long, it colors our image of the early parts of their career?
It's interesting you say that because I do hear that a lot. I've never felt that way. I've never thought like when Jordan came back to play on the Wizards that it changed anything about his last sequence with the Bulls, that famous like against the Jazz when he steals the ball, hits the game-winning shot, all that stuff. I have always thought of it like it's your job. Do it as long as you're able to be employed doing it, and you're not there to hone a storybook for people. And if people can't sort of parse the difference, then that's more on them than the actual reality of your career and sort of like the Disney type of arc people want to have. Like, I barely remember Carter from what he's doing. Now, I know he's like okay in 87. He's still with the Mets. In 88, the Mets were really good and they underachieved. And Carter was, I'm sure he was more than an average NL catcher at the time. But 86 is really like his last year. He's top five in MVP that you think about him. So he has this protracted window, Gary Carter. But yeah, he bumped around at the end. But like, I don't know. I've never really looked at anything like that. I look at sort of peak, and the thing that counts against me for Carter is, like I said, that he's done being dominant. He's as a star in his early 30s, and as we talked about recently, Fisk is going to go on and do what he's going to do until his mid 40s. But Carlton Fisk never led the league in major categories. He never led the league in like home runs or RBI, or he doesn't have anything like that. He tied for the league lead in triples in 1972, and he got hit by a lot of pitches, so maybe he led the league in that one year. But RBI, that is one big pelt on the belt right there.
See, I'm hoping for a reverse Carter career. I'm hoping for a few really great years late in my career that will offset the prior mediocrity.
You are going to be the Dwight Evans of Bangor Radio. And you're going to have like a borderline Hall of Fame case, and maybe someone on the committee later was like a buddy. Maybe it'll be me. Maybe I'll nudge you over the line, Kimball. Maybe I'll be like, oh, okay, I'll pull a Tony La Russa. Kimball deserves it. He had me on a lot.
I'll accumulate the numbers because I hang around so long.
Yeah, you have all those radio awards and all of that stuff, and your consistency, your Iron Man streak of shows, and Carrie's not there. Sometimes you have to be the person who phones people. So I don't know, man. I think you're within spitting distance.
All right. Well, a ways to go, hopefully. But good to know you're on the team if I need that vote down the stretch. Colin Fleming, check out Meathead Say the Realest Things. If you don't have it yet, what in the world are you waiting for? And look for more great works ahead, too. And as always, if you haven't, why have you not subscribed to the Many Moments More blog? Why are you not checking out ColinFlemingLit.com? Do yourself a favor. Do all those things. And listen to the suggestions Colin gives you every week here on Downtown. Thank you, my friend. We'll visit again next Tuesday.
Okay, sounds good.